The San Jose Sharks Audio Network is on 24 hours a day. Whether you're in the office or on the go, make sure that you download the Sharks SAP Center app and hit listen anytime. You can also find us on your computer by going to sjsharks.com/listen. If it's a game broadcast, breaking news, or a player feature, the place to find it is right here on the San Jose Sharks Audio Network.
Hey there, Sharks fans and friends. Long time no talk to. Welcome to season two of The Undercurrent. I'm your host, Tara Sloan, and I am thrilled to be back talking about the good in the game once again. I hope you all had a great summer, but hey, now that the days are just a little bit cooler, the nights are just a little bit longer, it is time for hockey, yeah? So to kick off season two, we thought we'd sit down with Sharks head coach David Quinn. Yes, we got a big name for you. And a man who had a monumental task ahead of him when he took the job last year, but who has managed to navigate the ups and downs of a rebuild, retool, I don't know what we're calling it still, but he's faced all of this with enormous optimism. As you'll hear, our conversation focuses more on his personal journey than it does the team, both because it's not fair to ask him about a team he doesn't even know yet. We spoke before camp, but also because his path alone has been such an interesting one. I am a big fan of David as a person, and you will be too. Enjoy.
You ready?
Ready to go.
It's really nice to see you.
Great to see you.
How are you? You look refreshed. Are you?
Yeah, talk to me in 2 months.
Yeah, I know. But how do you feel? Like, I mean, you're back. You've had some semblance of a summer, at least.
You know, when August hits, I think if you talk to any hockey coach, they start getting the itch to come back and getting the season going. And, you know, I always judge my life by what type of golf I'm playing. And my golf game usually goes south in August because your focus starts shifting to, you know, the season, and you know, we're just excited to be back and looking forward to get going.
Do you take time away from hockey mentally?
Yes. You do? Yes, you do, for sure. But I think we, you know, all of a sudden it's been a few weeks and you know, you're seeing your friends and you get home and all of a sudden you start getting a little guilt and you start doing a little bit of work, and so that usually kicks in every now and then through the course of the summer. You want to stay sharp and you want to continue to improve as a coach, but you definitely need to take the time off and recharge your batteries because it's such a long season.
You also had your summer cut short a little bit for a great reason. You were coaching at the World Championships. What kind of bonding does that do? Because, I mean, your coaching staff was made up of so many of the coaches from here in San Jose.
Yeah, we're very fortunate. I'm incredibly fortunate to have the staff that we have here. Not only do we have a great relationship professionally, but we've got a great relationship personally. All of us do, and we love spending time together. We have a lot of laughs. You know, when I got lucky enough to get offered that job to go over the World Championships, it was really a no-brainer from my end of it to bring the guys that I've been working with all year. And not only great coaches, they're great people, and you know, I think our players can see that, and that can only help your organization when you see a staff that has that type of camaraderie and type of respect and get along the way we do.
Okay, so we spend so much time focusing on the players for a good reason, but how do you feel about a focus on you and your life?
Let's keep talking about the players. It's all about the players.
But your journey is actually, it's so interesting. So, I mean, I want to know, just from the beginning, what kind of a role did hockey play for you growing up in Rhode Island as a kid?
Hockey has given me everything. It's given me incredible friendships. It's given me education. It's given me an opportunity to travel. I mean, I owe my whole life to hockey in so many ways, and I can't believe on a daily basis that I'm in the situation I'm in. I feel so fortunate, and, you know, I was actually playing golf with Joe Thornton yesterday, and he's like, you're one of 32, you know that, right?
Yeah.
And it's been an incredible journey. I've loved every stop along the way, and people ask me all the time, you like, you know, college hockey better than pro hockey, what's the difference? And I mean, I've loved every stop along the way, whether I was coaching the U.S. national program, college hockey. I've coached women national teams. I've loved it all, and it's just, I'm so fortunate.
We're going to zigzag around because I want to know more about your life, but you mentioned the women. You assisted with the women just after they first got into the Olympics, so in the late 90s. I mean, that's an epic, epic group of women.
Yeah.
Finally, in 2023, now there's the PWHL, the Pro League, just about to start.
Yeah.
Late,
late for sure.
But yeah, what did you think when you heard that news?
I was excited for the game. I was excited for the women's game, obviously. They're incredible athletes. They're great people. You know, to be on the ice with them at that stage of my career and not really having been exposed to women's hockey, my level of respect for them grew more than it was before. I had a sister who was a great athlete, so I knew women were great in athletics. But to watch the women's game evolve the way it has is great. It could have been quicker, but I'm just really happy for the sport of women's hockey and hockey in general, because the more people we have playing it, the more enjoyable it is for everybody.
Amen. Okay, so you mentioned your sister. I want to know what it was like growing up, Quinn. And were you like a Dave? Were you a Davey? Like,
always David.
Were you always David?
Always David,
okay,
yeah.
So young David gets on skates when?
4 years old. I grew up in Cranston, Rhode Island, and you couldn't have asked for a better environment for where I grew up. I literally grew up across the street from three baseball fields, four basketball courts, the city pool, and a pond. So sports were everything to me, and I played them all and loved them all. And, you know, as you're going along in life, you kind of start being better in one of them, and hockey was the one. When I went to the Kent School, I left home at 15 to go to boarding school in 1980, which was rare back then. And, you know, my father was a cop, my mother drove a school bus, so prep school was never on my radar. I never heard of any of these prep schools because, don't forget, back then there was no internet and no cell phones, which most of our audience won't believe. But it was just, again, like I said, hockey has given me everything, and sports were everything to me. And I grew up in an incredible family, my mother and father. I couldn't ask for better parents, great sisters and brother. Very, very fortunate.
Who was your team?
Oh, the Bruins. I'm all New England all the time, you know, but then you get older and you get into pro sports. They're not my team anymore, obviously.
I should hope not. Okay, and who did you want to be when you grew
Ray
up?
Ray Bourque was my guy. Oh, Ray, yeah. Bourque. Obviously I saw Bobby Orr play, but when I really appreciated hockey and loved hockey, Ray Bourque was a guy that I followed. But my favorite athlete of all time is Larry Bird.
Ah.
So, but from a hockey perspective, it's Ray Bourque.
What do you think now that hockey has become so specialized, that kids play hockey year round and don't necessarily get to dabble in other sports? You know, I think back in your day, you had to be a multi-sport athlete. Now you don't.
Right.
What would you say to a parent who's thinking of, you know, really fast-tracking their kid?
I mean, I know how much football, when I played football in prep school, I never played football before, because when I was growing up, I was always 20 pounds over the weight limit to play youth football. So when I finally got to high school, I was able to play football, and I know how much that helped me. It 100%, it helped me in hockey. I was always a baseball player. I loved baseball. I know it helped me with my hand-eye coordination. I wish I had played lacrosse as well, because I think that's a great transfer to hockey. But I just, this hockey, and there's so many aspects of hockey, so much athleticism in the sport of hockey, that I think you can really benefit from playing other sports, which will improve you as a hockey player. So, and I know a lot of people say this, but it's just so true. It's, you play other sports. It's just, it's so important, not only for you to meet other people in different sports, but I think it will help you in hockey if that's going to be the sport that you're willing to pursue or want to pursue. And, you know, I think as a society, we look around and say, oh, you know, my neighbor's playing, you know, he's got the skills coach and he's playing hockey 12 months a year. I'm going to fall behind. And, you know, it's hard. I get it. It's hard to not think along those lines and to fall in that trap. But I just don't think there you can put a value on what it's like as a youngster and a young person to play multiple sports.
But for you, your path became pretty exclusively hockey at a certain point. NHL was the goal, right?
Yep. NHL was 100% the goal. Yeah.
And I don't know if, you know, the entire audience would know that you're a first-round draft pick.
I was a first-round draft pick. Yes, I was.
Yeah. I mean, like, just go back to that. I know, obviously, a lot has changed in your life. And. Yeah. Your trajectory did change, but I mean, what's that like?
You know, again, no internet, no cell phones, growing up in Cranston, Rhode Island, playing prep school hockey at the Kent School in Connecticut, you only know your own little world. And, you know, nowadays everybody knows everybody in their age group, whether if you're in Massachusetts, you know who the best player is in Arizona or California or Michigan or Minnesota. There was none of that when I was growing up. And like I said, I played three sports in prep school, football, baseball, and hockey. And, you know, back then, the recruiting process was normal, where you get recruited as a senior in high school, not as a ninth grader. So I was hoping, I'll never forget going to my junior, I'm like, God, I hope one of these sports offers me an opportunity to go to college. And my junior year in high school really kind of elevated me in the hockey world. And I'll never forget, I was playing in a Christmas tournament in Nobles and Greeno. Prep school hockey's big, and the Christmas tournaments are huge. In the very first game, after the second period, you actually have to walk through the crowd to get to the locker rooms. And as I'm walking between the second and third period, five people asked me when my birthday was. And I thought, this is going to be one great birthday. I'm going to get a lot of presents. And I found out there were NHL scouts there. And then after that, but I kept playing. It didn't really dawn on me. And that summer, I remember people telling me, hey, you can make a career out of this. And, you know, it just changed my life in a lot of ways. And then that my senior year was my draft eligible year. And, I mean, there were 21 teams at every one of my games. And, you know, and then after the season ended, go up to Montreal and get drafted in the first round. And it was hysterical because back then high school players weren't getting drafted in the first round. Huh. And I remember sitting in the stands.
Not just back then.
No, I know.
Not too many Casey Mittelstadts all around, right?
No, like, I remember sitting in the stands and all the major junior kids in one section, me, my mother and father, Jack Parker, my coach to be at BU, Clark Donatelli, my teammate I was going to play with at BU, and our agent or advisor at the time, John Howe, was sitting, just six of us in one set of stands. And when I got picked 13th overall, I could see all the major junior kids going, who the hell's this kid? You know, they never heard me, heard about me, you know? So it was a pretty special time.
Unreal. Okay, so, you know, there are the Patrick Marleaus of the world. Well, not too many of those.
No.
Who just play and play and play. And then for you, that wasn't the case. Your career was ultimately cut short on the ice because of illness.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened and how that whole thing went down.
Well, when I got to BU, I knew I wasn't ready to play in the National Hockey League, and I certainly didn't want to go play in the minors. I thought, you know, I could get a great education at BU and continue to pursue my dream to play in the National Hockey League. And BU was one of the top programs in the country. I was going to go play for a great coach and a bunch of close to my home, and it was a logical thing to do. You know, my career started at BU. I was really starting to get injured more than I ever had. And as the season went on, I had an injury, blood-related injury, called compartment syndrome. Halfway through my freshman year, missed about 10 games, so that kind of derailed my freshman year. My second year at BU, I stayed relatively healthy, but still a lot of blood-related injuries, all bruising, unexpected bruising. No idea what happened. And we won the hockey. I was having my best season, was, you know, all hockey, second team All-American. It was really the year that I really started elevating my play and felt good about the direction of where I was going. And I'll never forget winning the hockey's championship, and we were playing in the national tournament the next weekend. But Dr. Leach, our team doctor, as he was coming around congratulating everybody, I had missed the two games that year, and they were in the first round of the playoffs. I had a contusion in my thumb and thigh. I had two contusions, hematomas in my thigh and my thumb. And he said, you know, after the season, I want you to get your blood checked. He said, all your injuries have been blood-related since you've been here at BU. I didn't think anything of it. You know, we play in the national tournament. We end up losing. The next day, I get a phone call. Minnesota wanted to sign me. Back then, you couldn't play in the Olympics.
Right.
If you signed an NHL contract, this was in 1986. I really wanted to play in the 88 Olympic team. That year, I played in the U.S. team in the World Juniors. We had won our first medal ever. And I just wanted to play in the Olympics. But I was tempted. I was deciding what to do. And the day the season ended, I did go and get my blood checked. And then when I went in to see Jack Parker 3 days later to talk about my next move, whether I was going to stay at BU or leave, a team doctor was there. And when I walked in, I knew something was up. Mm-hmm. And what Dr. Leach told me and what Coach Parker told me, he said, your blood test came back and you're hemophiliac. And I didn't know what hemophilia was. And this is 1986 again, and, you know, I said, well, what do we do? And they said, well, there's really not much you can do. We can't believe you've survived sports this long, and you have to quit. So, you know, at 20 years old, thinking that, you know, your life for the next 15 years was going to be mapped out, you're going to play in the National Hockey League, and that was a pretty devastating blow.
So you did ultimately return to the ice,
yep.
Right? At some point, there was some treatment available to you?
So what happened, ironically, how I did this, I'll never know, but I talked BU, my doctor, and my parents, and they let me play that year. I wore a special helmet. I figured, hey, if I've survived this long, you know, so again, missed 10 games with a thigh contusion, almost have surgery again, still more problems, but still felt good about the direction of my game. I get invited to the Olympic trials that summer. And 2 weeks before the trials, I was playing a pickup basketball game at BU, and I sprained my ankle. And it was pretty severe this time. I ended up getting rushed to the hospital at 4 o'clock in the morning that night. I had so much bleeding into my leg. And I had compartment syndrome again. This was much more serious. I spent 5 weeks in the hospital and my career was over.
I'm sure it feels really different to talk about it now. At the time, I mean, what was happening to your heart and your dreams? You know?
Yeah, I mean, 20 years old, 21 years old at the time, and actually I was 20 the second time. You just, you know, I wasn't equipped to handle it. And you certainly feel sorry for yourself, and you change a little bit, you know, pretty doing some immature things. And then after 2 years of that, I got my life back in order, graduated from BU, and, you know, like you said, there was medicine. Ironically, I was off the ice for 4 years, and all of a sudden there's some medical advancements. So I was part of a government protocol for a drug company that came out with a clotting factor for my blood. And Dave Peterson, ironically, was a 92 Olympic coach. He was also the 88 Olympic coach. He was also my world junior coach, so I had a lot of connections to Coach Pete. And what happened back in 91 was I ended up being part of this protocol, which allowed me to come back to try to play. And I would take 6,000 units of this factor of 9, which would raise my clotting level. I'd be just like everybody else out there. And I tried to come back after being off for 4 years. I had major surgery on the leg. I lost some movement in my right foot. And I told myself, I'll give myself 2 years. If I don't get to the National Hockey League, I'm going to move on with my life. You know, it was just too many hurdles to overcome. You know, got cut in January for the 92 Olympic team, played in the International League for 1 year, and then incredibly fortunate to get an opportunity to get into coaching.
So we're going to get to that in just a second, but I actually want to know what that experience, I mean, you know, when things are just derailed in a way that you can't predict.
Right.
You said you changed a little bit. I mean, yes, okay, you did some I don't know, reckless things perhaps, but I'm sure it also, you know, changed you, helped you. You probably grew up really quickly in a way.
Big time.
Do you think that informed you as a coach?
100%. I think, you know, we're all formed by our life's experiences, and sometimes those type of situations and experiences really hurt short term. And if you can be mentally tough enough to overcome it, you're going to be a better person regardless of what profession you choose. And, you know, for me, I wouldn't change anything, as crazy as that sounds. I mean, I learned an awful lot from it. I think I became a better person from it. And, but it wasn't easy, that's for sure.
No, I can't imagine. So, coaching. Yeah. So how did it happen?
Well, Ben Smith, who recruited me to go to BU, he and I became very close after I had to quit playing. He was someone I leaned on heavily when I was going through my toughest times, as was Jack Parker, and was my head coach at BU, and Larry Piatelli and Peter Bragdon, who brought me to the Kent School. And, you know, when I knew I wasn't going to play anymore, I thought, God, you know, it'd be pretty cool to get into coaching and have the type of impact on somebody that my coaches have had on me. And ironically, Ben was the head coach at Northeastern at the time. He had just lost his number one assistant. I decided I wasn't going to play anymore, and he asked me to be his assistant coach at Northeastern. And, you know, I certainly owe everything to him for what he's done for me, not only professionally but personally. And it's just something I had such a passion for and loved doing from the minute I started it.
Yeah, well, okay, so young coach, Dave, What were your characteristics? Like, what drew you to that?
I love people. And, you know, I was 26 years old when I got into it. But, you know, being the son of a cop, you know, I've got that little bit of an edge sometimes. And, you know, I think I loved being around our players. I loved trying to make them better. And that was right from the get-go. It was just something that I just loved to do and loved the relationship piece of it. And I think if you're going to be an effective coach, there's got to be that sincere layer of a relationship where your players know you care about them. And once you have that, anything's possible.
Do you have a singular philosophy? Do you have like kind of a motto or just a way you think a coach should be?
I think this is big in this day and age, regardless of what you do in life. It's managing accountability with likability. You know, when you're trying to hold people accountable, there's got to be a likability factor to you, but that doesn't happen overnight, and there's got to be sincerity to it. You know, you can't be a phony. You got to genuinely care about the people you're leading and the people that you're coaching, because a player can sense a phony a mile away. And, you know, to me, I've always felt like I've been hard on my players, but fair. And, That's all I ever wanted to be, was fair. People recognize fairness when they see it, and the people that don't recognize it are probably going to be the people that you're not going to move forward with anyway. So, right. You know, to me, that's the balancing act and being hard on people but fair.
What about a willingness for you to learn through this process? I mean, you've been doing it for so long, as you said, and you know, in so many different capacities.
Right.
Are you open to learning lessons every day you're out there?
I am. Probably a better question to ask our assistant coaches, but I think they would tell you that I'm 100% open to opinions and listening and very collaborative. And, you know, that's what I want. I mean, I want to surround myself with people that aren't just like me or think the way I do. I want to encourage people to give me their opinion. And there's been plenty of occasions in the last year where maybe I thought something should happen or could happen, and they've brought a different perspective, and we've done it that way. So, I mean, to me, that's imperative if you're going to be a good leader.
I feel like I would just cry all the time.
Well, there's plenty of times I want to cry.
Yeah, I feel like I would. First of all, you've mentioned Jack Parker a number of times and the other coaches who helped you along the way. Do you still talk to your mentors?
I talked to Jack about 2 weeks ago, and Ben Smith and I talk frequently. You know, it was funny when I actually went back after coaching for, I think, 10 or 11 years of coaching. I went back to BU as Jack's associate head coach. And I always knew I learned a lot from him, but I'll never forget the first practice, and we're playing in practice, and after the first week, I thought to myself, holy moly, I didn't realize how much I actually learned from him and how similar I am in my approach to the game as Jack was, right? Because I hadn't been around him for a long time professionally, but it was amazing when I went back to work with him how similar my philosophy was and my approach to coaching was.
Okay, well, what is that? Explain it.
Hard but fair, and very adaptable. The thing about Jack, you don't coach as long as Jack did and not be adaptable. And you got to know what you don't know. And Jack was great at that. And he had a great presence about him. He cared about his players. And I like to think I took some of that along the way with me.
So if people want to know your trajectory, first of all, people probably know, or they can Google, because we all go through the whole thing, and I don't need to ask you, you know, about every stop along the way.
Right.
But ultimately, the important point is, here you are.
Here I am.
And it was Mike Greer who brought you in, and your story with him is so interesting. So when did you first meet Mike, and what was your kind of, you know, journey and how you almost ended up together?
Right. So I coached against Mike when I was in Northeastern. He was at BU, and he was steamrolling us and everybody else in college hockey. And you know, I love working out. I love, you know, being around people that work out. And I still obviously have my connections at BU when I was in Northeastern, and the two campuses are a mile away. So Mike and I would cross paths. And, you know, Mike and I probably had similar challenges as athletes. I was a little bit heavy when I got to BU, and Mike was a little bit heavy when he got to BU. So, you know, but we just built a little bit of a friendship along the way. And, you know, when Mike retired from coaching, he was around Boston. I happened to be the head coach at BU at the time, and he came to work out every day at BU. And we talk a lot. You know, he'd come and watch practices, and we talk hockey, and, you know, we just built a friendship. And I actually tried to hire him at BU once, and I don't think Ann wanted him out of the house just yet, so that didn't work out. And then actually talked about hiring him in New York when I was with the Rangers, and that didn't work out. And, you know, when he got this job and called me and asked me if I'd be interested, it was really a no-brainer for me. For so many reasons, and we certainly knew the challenge that we were faced here in San Jose, but there's nobody I'd rather be doing this with than Mike.
What do you think are his strongest attributes as a GM in this role?
He's very thorough, and he's very even-keeled. I mean, he works as hard as anyone I've been around in the sport. He listens to people, and he's very even-keeled, which I think you need to be as a general manager. A lot more even keel than I am as a coach.
Well, that's the balance.
I'm working on it.
That's
I'm working on it too.
I'm not a coach. I mean, so obviously, you know, there's a lot to digest when it comes to last year. You said you knew it was going to be a challenge, as did we all. What are your takeaways?
Two words jump out at me: frustration and encouragement. Because I can't tell how many times a game would end or we'd be sitting around and look at how the hell do we have the record? We feel like we're playing better than this, you know, and I'm not saying we would have led the NHL in points, but we just felt our play was better than what our record was. And I'll never forget talking to Cooch in early December, and he just said, I can't believe we have the record we have. I just can't. He said, well, I really feel like we're playing good hockey, and, you know, we play teams. I know teams say things to you, but you know, Nick Bonino gets traded to Pittsburgh, and he tells me to start one of their plays. He goes, how the hell did you guys have the record you have? He goes, we played you twice in the last month. Like, you know, so, you know, frustrating because of that, but encouraging because when you just watch, we felt like we were going in the right direction. Like we were, you know, liked the way we were playing, liked the team that we had, liked our leadership group. We got some good core pieces here. And, you know, so obviously you're not happy with the record by any stretch of the imagination, but there certainly were some things to feel good about when the season ended.
It appeared to us, and I know we only see the kind of tip of the iceberg, but your outlook seemed to be generally positive. Is that a, sort of an active thing where you just, you're very intentional about finding the positivity in the game?
Listen, I think our number one responsibility is to create an environment where these guys want to come here every day. Now, that doesn't mean I throw out a picnic table and we have brownies and milk every day. I mean, there are some hard days, too.
Do you sometimes have brownies
sometimes,
and milk?
No, not brownies. You got to watch what we eat. But, you know, to me, it's an environment where you want to come to, but you want to come here to work hard and you want to be involved. You want to be all in physically and mentally every single day, which is a challenge in this league. And as a coach, you better have a good pulse of your team and understand, you know, when to lean on them and when to back off a little bit. And that's what's so great about, you know, the assistant coaches that we have here. They've built great relationship with these guys. You know, I feel confident in the relationships that I have with them that we're all in this together. This isn't a coach versus player situation. I don't think you can have success that way, but there's a level of respect and likability from the coaches to the players and the players amongst themselves that give us a chance to be successful. And that's what we have to continue to do.
You come into a market and it's not just about being at the rink. It's about being part of the community. I mean, this is really for everybody.
Right.
And you really, you put yourself out there. I don't know if you know how much it meant to the San Francisco Earthquakes team for you to get behind the bench when they were doing the scrimmage before the Pride game. But things like that have a lot of meaning and impact. Why is that kind of thing important to you?
I'm so fortunate that I have a job that people are interested in. And, you know, people say to me, you're not bothering me. I mean, I love what I do. I love that people love what we do. I love that people love hockey. Without our fan base and without people that love hockey, we don't have the jobs we have. So I think people in our organization know as a staff, and certainly myself and Mike, and if whatever you need us to do to, you know, make people feel good about the Sharks, I'm not only willing to do, but I want to do it. Mm. And, you know, to me, that was an unbelievable night for me. I loved being behind the bench with those guys and girls, and it was such a fun experience. And, you know, to me, that's our responsibility. But you can't just do it because it's your responsibility. There's got to be a personality trait that makes you enjoy doing it. Mm-hmm. And I do. I love people. I love being around people. And it was a great night.
So here we are. I'm catching you before the rookies play, before camp. So, I mean, there's a lot TBD.
I love everybody right now.
So I won't ask you any specifics, but I guess I'll just ask how you're feeling kind of heading into this time of year.
I always feel good, and I'm not just saying that. I mean, to me, if you're going to be good, you better think you're good. And, you know, I look at our roster and I look what we have, and I know there are a lot of naysayers and people that are picking us in certain spots, but we certainly don't feel that way as a team. And, you know, we've got a couple players here that, you know, people would die to have in Logan Couture and Tommy Hertl that we can build around. Sure. And not only are they great players, they're great people. And I feel very good about where we're at. I do. And, you know, we can't wait to get going. And I think it's 9 days, 10 days. It's, you know, you get here and you want to go right away. You're like, oh, we still have 2.5 weeks before we get going. But I'm very optimistic about our season. But, you know, I'm always optimistic about our season because, you know, and it's sincere. I really like our group in a lot of ways. And there are certain things we're going to have to do. We certainly got to give up less goals. We've got to be a little bit more responsible with the puck. But I think we have an opportunity here to surprise a lot of people.
Well, thank you for your time. It's so nice to see you.
Great
and
to see
we
you.
Were lucky to have you.
Thank you.
A huge thanks to David for his time and his perpetual glass half full attitude. By the way, this interview is also available in video form if you like that kind of thing. A reminder, The Undercurrent is put together by media superstar and audio whiz kid Ted Ramey. Music is by Blinker the Star, and I'm your host, Tara Sloan. We will talk soon. Yes, we will. In the meantime, keep your fins above water. It is so good to be back.